Peter R. Breggin, M.D., is called the conscience of psychiatry for his many decades of successful reform efforts. His scientific and educational work provide the foundation for modern criticism of drugs and ECT and lead the way in promoting more caring and effective therapies. His books include Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, Medication Madness, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, and now, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, Understanding and Overcoming Negative Emotions. Welcome to the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour.
Hello, hello, around the world, to the best audience in the world, on a whole range of subjects, psychiatry, psychology, the harm done by psychology and psychiatry, the good often done by psychotherapy, but not always, on the subjects of science pertaining to anything to do with human life, the best audience in the world. It is so good to be talking with you again. This week on my website, which grows bigger and bigger in its audience, I put up a frequent alert called Get Breggin. It's about one of the early efforts to stop me when I was conducting my anti-psychosurgery campaign in the early 1970s, when I first ran into everything from, death threats, incarceration threats, things I have written very little about. And I begin in this first blog on the subject to talk about what it was like in the early years and what it continues to be like to speak truth to power. Meanwhile, the work I'm doing continues to expand and to grow in many ways, many new ways. It's odd to think about being in my 81st year and having more interesting books that I'm writing, and to be having a novel sitting at an agency, which I'm hoping will forget that I'm famous for writing about what's wrong with psychiatry and instead have an inspiring novel about the meeting between people and dogs 20,000 years ago. Because I want to talk about human nature and what's great and good about it, and part of it is dogs. My guest today, Peter Goetze, I don't have enough to say about him. I mean, I have no way to say enough about him, how much I admire and respect him and how much I care for him as a person, my deep affection for him, my feeling that he is one of the great hopes for a continued expansion of not only looking critically at medicine and psychiatry, but also looking at what is good and what works, because his mind and his interests are already moving in that direction as well. Although he hasn't published a lot on it, he will be. So Peter Goetze is, he's just such an important human being and friend. Now, you'll find him easily enough if you just Google his latest book, Deadly Psychiatry and Organized Denial. Deadly Psychiatry and Organized Denial. And if you're an American and you want to struggle with his last name, his name is Peter C. Goetze, G-O-T-Z-S-C-H-E. And Peter is very well known for decades before he got interested in psychiatry as a professor and as a trained internist who founded or helped found the Cochrane organization that has done so much to provide a high level of research and research criticism. And I think it was Peter's realizing that even the studies approved by his own group he founded, the Cochrane folks, that the psychiatry was trash, that partly led him into becoming so interested in the problems in psychiatry. And before the show started, I Skype phoned Peter, and you're there, Peter. I hope.
Yes, and I can hear you, Peter.
Oh, great. And I hear you very, very well. Good, good. And so can the audience. I was chatting with Peter about one of the subjects that he wanted to talk about, which was involuntary treatment and hospitalization in general, and is there any reason to believe it works? And then we went on to talk about my new blog, which is attached to my frequent alerts about the Get Breggin. And he thought it was a really good thing I was doing that, and I said I thought it'd be a good thing too if he talked about some of what he's been up against. And believe me, we're only scratching the surface. And I'm really just going to be talking about these issues on and off now, probably for a long, long time, on and off, because it's so important for people to know why folks like me and Peter Gerze and Bob Whitaker ultimately have such a struggle against violence in many ways, violence directed at us, and certainly in my case, directly directed at me in the early years. So we're going to have a theme today that I've never had before, and it's a theme about force in psychiatry, how it's used against patients and critics alike. So that's our subject for today, spontaneously developed. Psychiatry, how it uses force on its patients and its critics. So, Peter, welcome once again to the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour.
Thank you.
Where would you like to begin, my friend?
Oh, I would certainly like to begin with what I experienced just 2 days ago, because there was a full-day meeting about custody in psychiatry when people are considered dangerous, and instead of going to jail, they are confined to a psychiatric institution. I don't know the English word for that. What is it you call it?
Commitment. Civil commitment. First, there's certification where almost any healthcare professional, sometimes one, sometimes two required, can certify you for a limited time, often in the 24-hour range, 48, 78 hours. And then there's court commitment that's required for the longer stays. The patients almost never win their battle against court commitment.
No. And I have witnessed terrible abuse of the Danish law recently. So I think you should hear this story.
Please.
It was a man who was so much against Danish soldiers fighting in Afghanistan that he wanted to get them home. So he sent a letter to the head of state in Denmark threatening his life if he didn't withdraw the Danish soldiers. That was, of course, very stupid of him. And what happened was that he got this psychiatric sentence, that he was confined in a psychiatric institution in order to protect our head of state against his threats. Now, what do you do in these institutions? Well, very often you treat with drugs, but I don't know any drug that can reduce the risk of violence, whereas many psychiatric drugs, they do the opposite. They increase the risk of violence. But this man didn't escape getting treated with olanzapine called Zyprexa, an antipsychotic drug. But then he is very intelligent, so he studied Danish law. And whenever the psychiatrist did something that was against the law, he complained about it officially, and he won. So, of course, he wasn't terribly popular at the closed institution where he was. He also succeeded to get rid of the psychiatric drugs. And then he started to make notes about how the staff behaved towards him, because his argument was, they're making notes about me all the time, so now I'm going to make notes about the staff, including the psychiatrists. And he even contacted a Danish institution, and he learned that it was not against the law to make such notes, provided they were only for private use. So there was absolutely nothing wrong with it. Then he was called to a meeting with one of the psychiatrists, and she told him that this was not normal behavior to do notes like that. So now she would resume treatment with the antipsychotic Zyprexa. And he asked her, what was the reason for that? How could she say it was abnormal to make notes? What was wrong with that? And what did she want to get out of the treatment? So he posed a lot of rational questions to her, but she insisted that if he didn't want to take the drug, it was clear that she could force him. Now, unfortunate for her, he recorded the whole conversation and put it up on YouTube.
Oh, my.
It's the most horrendous I have ever heard. And this happened just 2 or 3 years ago in Denmark. We are not talking about the Soviet Union under Stalin some 50, 60 years ago. He died in 53. No, we are talking about nowadays in Denmark. And he has put up a lot of other secret recordings on YouTube. I haven't listened to them, but I have just listened to this one. And 2 days ago, I actually met with the man who had corresponded with me several times over the years. So he is now free and out in society, doesn't take drugs, and he is absolutely normal. And what is more to this story is that in order to get him confined in a psychiatric institution, some psychiatrist made a mental health report about him, stating that he was psychiatrically ill, of course. But unfortunately, there was another psychiatrist who presumably didn't know about the first one, who also did a mental health examination of him and concluded that he was normal. There was nothing wrong with him. So there we have had this man being in an institution for several years, who actually saw it as a challenge to challenge the authorities and say when they broke the law, because he sees his fight as something that can benefit other psychiatric patients. So he is a very unusual person, and it was nice to say hello to him 2 days ago. And I just don't have words for this. It was so clear also during the conversation that he taped that here we have a completely normal person who has very understandable reasons for making notes about what the staff does to him, because they, on several previous occasions, had broken the law. And he had won when he complained about it. So it's very understandable that he had had enough. So, Peter, what do you say about this story?
First, before we get to that, do you have any idea how long they managed to incarcerate him?
No, I don't have all the details, but we are talking about years.
Years ago. And the other question is,
but he was confined for years.
Yeah.
He
was
came out
confined for years. Oh, boy.
Yeah, he came out quite recently, I think. And he could have come out earlier, but he had some demands before being released. I don't know the details, but there is a Danish journalist who are very interested in this story, so it will become public.
And is there a way, can you give his name or some other information that would let people, including me, listen to his secret tape?
Of course I can do that, but it's in Danish.
Oh, okay. Oh, that would be amazing to get that translated. That's
We can talk about that later, and with the various translation facilities like Google Translate, it isn't such a big job to have things translated.
One of the things the story reminds me so much of that I mentioned to you earlier when we were chatting is back in the early 70s, the famous Rosenhan study out of California, where the professor of psychology sent in a group of normal people to emergency rooms just saying they were feeling fine and everything was okay, but they were hearing a voice saying, "Hollow." And they all got hospitalized and they all got diagnosed with schizophrenia and they all were put on drugs, or most of them, and they cheeked it and were easily able to avoid taking them at that point. That's before the long-acting drugs were in such common use. And in general, often the patients knew that these people were not suffering from a psychiatric problem, and they went up to them and would talk to them about it. Whereas the staff always agreed, nurses, aides, whoever saw the person's occupational therapy, group therapy, you know, that he was a suitable mental patient suffering from something requiring his presence. And some of the patients would ask, you know, "Are you a reporter? What are you doing here?" And in particular, one of the experimental patients who came in, it was normal, started to take notes, which ties it into your story. And so that led other patients to conclude he was a reporter. They just, you know, was a plant in there to report. But the nurse's notes said that he was suffering from writing behavior.
Yes.
So,
yes.
I mean.
So we must be suffering as well, you and I, Peter. We write a lot.
Well, yes. And of course, I got shifting over actually into attacks on me and attacks on you, Peter. I was diagnosed in the scientific literature without using my name, but it was able to diagnose me. You could tell who it was. And it was in a big magazine. I think it was Science Magazine, big new important magazine, really a journal. That I was a schizophrenic paranoid for wanting to stop lobotomy.
Oh, my goodness. This is the top story.
And that is going to be a follow-up story in a few weeks. It'll be my next story, a follow-up story in, so I'm not going to tell it all, in my frequent alerts. And this fellow made some other remarks, and at the time I had no money at all. I had spent my entire income fighting lobotomy and ultimately stopping it throughout North America and most of Europe, but it took years. I was completely broke, but I found a lawyer who would sue him. And that's how I came to stop anybody from ever again diagnosing me, because the amount of his settlement, which I'll discuss in the blog, was considerable and allowed me to buy a country home and escape so I could get away from all this and also put some money in the bank to defend myself. And since then, I've never been diagnosed again, ever. In public. So it's good to remind folks about that. If you want to try to diagnose me again, you know, beware. There are damages from doing that, and it won't just be to me. So, oh, God, Peter, I have so many stories I could tell. And that story, I will. I'm going to tell it next. I didn't know that until this moment. But in a few weeks, I'm not gonna turn my frequent alerts into a discussion of attacks, but my wife and I have talked about it, and we just think that it's important to get this out, you know, piece by piece over time as to what in the world it has been like standing up to psychiatry and and why it is that there's so few of us doing it. And you've been up against that too, Peter. I mean, we could move on and talk some about the attacks you've been under, or why don't we do that? Why don't we talk about some of the, if not attacks, bizarre experiences you've undergone trying to speak scientifically in the midst of psychiatrists?
Oh, well, I will detail some of my experiences in a new book that will come out next year that I have just finished. And one of my experiences was in a double homicide case in Holland where I was an expert witness and where I criticized the other expert witness. I criticized his report quite heavily, but it was deserved. And then in the middle of the court proceedings, he asked for permission to distribute something he had written in Dutch, making sure that I couldn't understand it, and the judges allowed him to distribute his paper in Dutch to people in court. And over lunch, a Dutch person translated it for me, and on the first page, he claimed that I was disinhibited and ought to be examined, obviously, by a psychiatrist. So here I am, a recognized expert witness that has criticized his report heavily. And then the next thing I see is that I am getting diagnosed. And of course, I told the court that it was unfair to me. It was unfair to the poor mother who committed the crimes under influence of paroxetine. It was a typical drug harm that caused her to kill her children. And I tried to persuade the judges that this was the case and she should be set free. And of course, I didn't succeed because people don't understand these things. But when he didn't have any academic arguments, he started going after me and told the court there was something wrong with me. But the judges said that they would not take his silly paper into account. So that was just one of many weird experiences. I have experienced this several times that some psychiatrists, it's too tempting for them. If they get in trouble, they invent a diagnosis for you.
What capacity do you have to sue him for libel and slander the way I sued the psychiatrist I mentioned to you? And I'll talk about him and his name, you know, in the future, but... Do you have any recourse?
I have complained to the Dutch Medical Association because he's a doctor, he's a clinical pharmacologist who deals with psychiatric patients, and they just told me that they couldn't take my complaint because I wasn't a Dutch doctor, which is pretty foolish. This happened in Holland, and I was there. Then I complained to the university where he works, and I have written several emails to them. It's now almost 2 years ago I wrote the first one. The only thing they have done is to acknowledge that they received an email from me. They haven't dealt with the case, although it's deeply professionally unethical to behave like he did. But then I have a colleague in Holland whose brother-in-law is a lawyer, and he tells me that I should sue the bastard because I would surely win. And I don't know if I'll do it because it will cost money and I would have to go to Holland, but maybe I will. I'm tempted to do something about it, but will that make me happier? No, it won't.
Well, I'm very, very glad that on that one occasion I sued. And it was nowhere as near really as egregious as what this guy did. But, well, yes, it was, because he also said public things. And it had a very calming, tranquilizing effect, my victory, on the rest of the psychiatric profession. They just got calmer about me and less publicly accusatory. So you owe it to the profession as a therapy – and as a protection from you, for you, to sue him if it's feasible. But I have no idea about the difficulty of suing, you know, in Europe. But it certainly had a very good effect on my career, and it really put limits on the, these guys to know that, that I was going to take care of myself and would do so whenever it was necessary.
Yes. Yes. Well, maybe I will, because this brother-in-law is so interested in this injustice that has happened, both in terms of the mother who killed her two children, but also on a quite different scale towards me, that he might help me just pro bono in order to make an example that we won't tolerate this in Holland.
Yeah, I think so. Now, in this country, lawyers can take cases on speculation, in effect. And my lawyer did that in part because he was so enraged about what was done to me.
Yeah.
And so he then gets a he then got a percentage of what I won. I don't know if that can be done in Holland.
I'm not so familiar with how law firms operate, but we don't have the tradition as you have in the States with huge amounts of money in settlements. It's virtually unknown in Europe. So our situation is very different.
Yes, I kind of understand that. But it's also, easier to sue. I think it's easier to sue for libel and slander in, and you have both probably, in Europe. In England, that's the only place I know. I do believe that that it may be easier. So check it out. I mean, that'd be very interesting. And folks, you're hearing it here on the radio show. Maybe you're hearing the beginning of something very important. We have to fight back. We have to fight back.
If this had happened in England, I would probably have sued because they have very tough libel laws.
Yeah, that was my impression, but not so necessarily in. You're saying in Holland?
No. Okay. In Holland and Denmark and elsewhere, we don't have these tough libel laws. And if you kill a person by negligence, for example, I mean, those who are left behind might get something like $10,000 in compensation. I mean, in the United States, it would be many millions.
Could be, yes. Yeah. Tell us more about, I think it would be interesting for folks, it's certainly interesting for me, if you like, about some of the other things you've run into. Because, one of the things that's so important for folks to know is that this is not personal about us. You know, some people think that Peter Breggin is attacked because of something about Peter Breggin, for example. Well, no, I'm a really nice guy. I get along real well with folks. I'm now a distinguished elderly gentleman. No, it's about what I stand for and what the effect is of what I stand for. And that's the same like in your case. You had a very long career, which I didn't have before you took on psychiatry, of doing very distinguished scientific work in other fields. And then when you took on psychiatry, I think you kind of got a new kind of opposition, didn't you?
Well, yes. I have faced this before because I have done a lot of research on mammography screening and has documented that it doesn't work. This will probably shock the female listeners, but it doesn't. Women don't live longer because they attend mammography screening. And there's a lot of overdiagnosis where healthy women get a cancer diagnosis and get treated and all that sort of thing. And so I know what it feels like to go against the grain.
What happened to you when you took on the mammography issues?
Oh, it was all sorts of naughty things, like international congresses on breast cancer, where one of my colleagues from my own hospital showed a photo of me and with the text, "Who doesn't fear this man?" And then everybody laughed. Of course, that can seem a bit innocent, but it is not, because it's about making your opponents into witches. That's what it is about. And so I have been exposed to all sorts of things, being called all sorts of things, not psychiatric diagnosis, but something similar. When people don't have arguments, that's what they do, Peter, then they become very foolish. But you know that the bad thing about it is that it sometimes works. It hasn't worked in my case. I just become even more stubborn. And like in your case, some people realize that it doesn't work no matter how nasty they are against me. I'm still there, and I'm not a weak person. I get stronger the more opposition I meet. So, but you know perfectly well from the Nazis how propaganda can affect people by spreading false propaganda about the Jews. You know exactly how effective that was. So, of course, my friends get worried when I come under attack, but I calm them and say, "I'm not worried, I will survive." So I suppose it's a matter of what you have in your genes. It's nothing about being a hero.
I don't know about that. You seem pretty heroic to me, and there's so few of you. I don't know. But I too, don't understand exactly why I do what I do. You and I have probably been doing this since we were children in one way or another. That would be it. And my wife, Ginger, she literally took on the mayor of her town when she was 10 years old and eventually unseated him because of the abusive nature of the shelter, the animal shelter in the town.
Yeah,
she even had national publicity for it. As by the time she was 15 or so, so it may be that this stuff is maybe it is just we're born with it, but I don't know. I think it's so important for folks to know that in fact we do survive, and it's a very, very good life. And frankly, even if I knew in retrospect I wouldn't have survived, I wouldn't have changed it, I would have continued to do what I did, because I think the good life is lived by pursuing the principles you believe in. And and that doesn't always end well for you. And especially if you're in circumstances such as Nazi Germany, you may have saved a lot of Jews and no one's ever heard of you, so it doesn't make you famous. Or you may have been a Jew who fought back and took out some Nazis, but no one would ever hear of you.
Yeah.
But I really believe that the society needs people to live by their principles, and that it is the best way to live. Anything else about current opposition that you've been experiencing? Because folks, this is an endless conversation. Or do you want to move on to this issue of that I started with the beginning, that psychiatry coerces its patients and its critics? And talk about this issue, because you've become very interested in it. Peter, I first wrote about this in 1963 or 4. Believe it or not, one of my first papers published in the Archives of General Psychiatry was about the coercion. The title was "The Coercion of Voluntary Patients in an Open Hospital: How Even Those Patients Were Coerced by the Threat of Commitment and What the Effects Were on Them." But talk about what you've been doing in that area.
Yes, I can talk a little about the meeting 2 days ago. because it was arranged by an organization we have in Denmark for what we call socially exposed people, people who have a hard time in their lives. And the speakers were very good the whole day until the very last speaker, which was a psychiatrist. The other speakers were not psychiatrists. There were also two patients who had been abused by the system who told about their experiences. And they were highly interesting. But then came the forensic psychiatrist being the last speaker. And she was given the task to explain why it was that in Denmark we confine 4 to 10 times as many people as they do in Iceland, Norway, Sweden, and Finland. And it has been increasing. So what could we, why was this so? What could we do about it? How could we confine fewer people and get them quicker out into normal life? And then she started out by saying, oh, well, but I have other statistics. And then no comment, no slides, no data. So that's why my book is called Organized Denial. She started her talk by saying, okay, you say 4 to 10 times as many are confined in Denmark. I don't believe the numbers. That's what I write in my book again and again and again, that no amount of scientific data you present to some of these people will influence them. And then she didn't talk at all about her subject. How do we confine fewer people? She just talked about a lot else. And that was it. That was her talk. It was very strange that they can't see it themselves, that after the audience have entertained a full day with good speakers and two previous patients telling about horrendous abuses, then comes one of the psychiatrists and everybody can see, like in our famous Danish novel of The Emperor's New Clothes, did she forget her clothes? She didn't put any on. Everybody can see she's naked. I mean, how come they can't see it themselves and just feel they're doing a good job? I mean, it was unbelievable what happened. And then there was a panel discussion by the end. And I asked people on the panel, which included a forensic psychiatrist and someone from the human rights organization in Denmark and other people. And I asked them, well, you have told us today that the reason you put aside people is to prevent further crime. Now, since the patients tell us that it's worse to be confined to a psychiatric institution than going to jail, they would prefer to go to jail where they know what they can expect. And we know that when people go to jail, jails do not reduce crime, they increase them. So therefore, I asked the panel, how can you say that the purpose is to reduce crime? Isn't it likely that you increase crime by being violent towards these people, drugging them against their will and whatever you can do to them? And furthermore, I reminded them that there are no psychiatric drugs, as far as I know, unless you make a complete zombie out of people so that they cannot be violent, that reduces violence. But many drugs increase violence. So what do you mean about treating these people in a psychiatric confinement? It's usually always drugs you are talking about. And to me, it makes matters worse, both to put them in there and to treat them with drugs. Do you know what happened? There was dead silence. Up till then, the discussion had been very lively. But when I have asked them, where is the evidence for this, for what you're doing? There was dead silence. No one said a word. What do you think about that, Peter?
Well, I've reviewed the literature periodically over many decades, and I do not know of any studies that show that involuntary treatment protects society or helps people. And even more than that, I've seen no evidence that psychiatric hospitalization helps people.
No, no, we have evidence that it makes matters worse.
I think it makes matters much worse because it is so humiliating and generally stigmatizing that it becomes one of the most traumatic experiences of the individual's life. Now, there are exceptions. There are individuals who get a lucky break and have a brief hospitalization and maybe a nurse. They meet a nurse that's really interested or cares about them, or somebody in some other capacity, almost never the psychiatrist, but somebody who cares about them, and their hospitalization's brief, and they feel like it protected them from themselves for a while. I mean, I've seen people who have that experience occasionally, but overall, most people, after they've been hospitalized, would rather die than go back again.
That is my
impression.
Peter, it's not only an impression. This has been documented. There is a big Danish study that showed that the risk of suicide was 44 times increased if you ended up in a psychiatric ward compared to if you still stayed out in society. 44 times increased. And of course,
is that the new study, Peter? I know there's a new study that was out about, I was going to say, about what happens to people after discharge.
Let me get finished, because of course you would expect that it's the most severely affected patients that end up in a psychiatric ward, and then the explanation would be that's because of their disease that they kill themselves, because they are more ill than those who do not end up in a psychiatric ward. But actually, very strangely, the biases in this study actually supported the opposite view. So the Danish psychiatrist and also an editorial written by other people agreed that this looks very, very serious and we need to be very concerned about this.
Yeah, it's been some studies have correlated this, you know, with the SSRIs as well, because, you know, people get discharged on these drugs. VA study has, you know, indicated that that if you end up on the SSRIs in the VA system, and often in the hospitals, you have an increased suicide rate again. So the drugs play a role in it. And so does, I think, the humiliating circumstances and stigmatizing circumstances of most psychiatric hospitalizations.
Oh, just imagine what it feels like to be admitted with an acute psychosis, perhaps caused by extreme stress and a divorce or whatever, sexual abuse. And then you get admitted with an acute psychosis. And imagine that during your stay, you get forced treatment with these horrible antipsychotic drugs, that you're also told that you have a chemical imbalance in your brain, and that you will likely suffer from this schizophrenia for the rest of your life, and furthermore, that studies have shown that it's beneficial to just go on and on and on with these drugs. And then after a while, you are dismissed, and you have absolutely no hope. I have a chemical imbalance. I need to take this horrible drug for the rest of my life, but I can't function. I can't work. I can't think. I can't have sex. I can't do anything. Isn't that an invitation to suicide?
Excuse me, Peter. I'm just sitting here actually thinking about some of my clients. Most of my patients in my practice, Peter, are being withdrawn from drugs, or I'm treating them after they've been withdrawn, because almost everybody who comes to see me is on drugs. and yeah. some of them on pretty rough combinations. And I'm just thinking about sitting with a older woman who is a really lovely human being, extremely intelligent, who 25 years ago ran into a problem and was put on psych drugs and has gotten worse and worse, and then was told she had a biochemical imbalance, told that she had a genetic predisposition, which is a complete lie. We have no studies to confirm that. The studies all indicate it's environmental, not genetic. And she and I had talked about it before, and as she's coming off the drug, she got more of a sense, you know, of herself and her feelings. But letting go of the indoctrination given by 25 years of healthcare providers, even for such an intelligent woman, and me being able to continually discuss this with her, is so difficult. It's actually like, and I don't know I've made this comparison exactly like this before, Peter. It's like coming out of a cult after you come out of 20 years of psychiatry and needing a loving de-indoctrination, a loving debriefing that allows you to recover from the abusive lies that have been perpetrated upon you. It is just so sad.
Yes, it has definitely close similarities to breaking out of Scientology, for example.
Yes, and some of the extreme and usually small Christian cults in the U.S. They don't play a real big role in our country, but they're there. Any kind of cult-like experience. We're looking, folks, at an organization, psychiatry, that for hundreds of years, really, has survived on the basis of abusing and controlling people and rejecting its critics. One of my earlier shows, we discussed a play that was written several hundred years BC in which the playwright was ridiculing the prevailing Hippocratic opinion that doctors could treat craziness and that people needed drugs who were crazy. And the playwright was ridiculing this, and you come to the conclusion at the end of the play that the psychiatrist is the crazy one. So this conflict between wisdom and psychiatry has been going on a long, long time.
Well, I don't know if I dare say this, but now I'll try. What would you call a whole specialty that shares wrong views on the drugs they are using, and where there is so clear scientific evidence that these drugs come close to being utterly useless in terms of healing people, whereas they have a lot of terrible harms and kill many people and cripple many people, both physically and mentally? How can you sustain a belief that this system is good for people without, in some sense, being delusional? I mean, they say their patients are delusional, which reminds me of the times when I have been told that a patient was delusional because he had been on the internet and found out that antipsychotic drugs were dangerous. So I was flabbergasted and said, this is very rational. This is not being delusional. But it's you, psychiatric nurses and chief physicians in psychiatry, that are delusional when you think antipsychotics are good drugs. How on earth could you come to that conclusion? I don't diagnose other people, Peter, but when psychiatrists say about people who are perfectly rational, like the one I started to talk about in the beginning, who just made observations on the staff and then had to accept forced treatment, shouldn't we start talking about delusions on the other side of the table?
It sounds to me like your next book.
No, not really, but but and I don't like to use all these horrible.
My only question is whether we would do ourselves a disservice by actively calling psychiatry a delusional system, or whether we just need to scientifically show that it is a dreadfully wrong system. You know what it also reminds me of, Peter, which is that, and you've been so spot on about this, that this can't exist without a conspiracy. It cannot exist without a conspiracy between enormously powerful industries that lobby on local and national levels, that fund fake research, that oppose good research, that collude with the government, and so on and on. So, you know, maybe what you and I are doing right now is trying to take to another level just how to explain to people how thoroughly wrong and, to use another word, a loaded word, evil this system
but
is.
Peter, while you were talking, I looked up the definition of delusion, which is an idiosyncratic belief or impression maintained despite being contradicted by reality or rational argument. And you could also add results of randomized trials, the best science we have.
Yes.
So I'm not wrong by saying there's something delusional in here, but what you're alluding to is it's not politically a good thing to start using words like that. So I will only do it for now in your program and nothing more.
Well, I'm not sure, Peter, you know? I'm not sure because it does meet all those qualifications. One way in which it is not delusional is that it is doesn't fit the usual delusional because it's not idiosyncratic. It is a delusion supported by hundreds of millions of people, probably, but more importantly, it's a delusion financed and supported by a group that shares it. So it comes out of the idiosyncratic mode and gets more into some sort of shared societal delusions, which is one reason why I've often thought of it, an analogy to it being, well, Tom Zoss talked about an analogy to slavery, which would be that kind of mass violent delusion that is shared by many, many people to their own interest. And why I've often compared it in my mind to Catholicism in the 15th and 16th centuries, and when it was a state religion, and when it empowered itself and was empowered to destroy other human beings, torture them and kill them, and to suppress free speech in that manner. Because it has that quality of a religious, zealous ideology not based in science and reality. Now, there are good religions that are very loving, and then there are religions that are not very loving, and psychiatry gets very near into that. But finding the language is complicated in terms of how is it best to communicate with people. And I think we're doing a very good job right now of looking at the various ways, a very honest job of looking at the various ways. It's such a pleasure to talk with you. By the way, Peter Goertze we're talking to, and his book, the one that is changing minds around the world, is Deadly Psychiatry an organized denial. You're going to learn as much or more from reading Peter's books as reading mine. They're as honest, they're as forthright, they're as moral, they're as scientifically based, and I mean, it's just a miracle, Peter, to have you on the air and to have you writing and doing what you're doing. There, I simply didn't have a colleague like you until you. And I thank you.
Oh, dear. there are so few of us. That's terrible.
Well, we're down to about 5 minutes. And, folks, you can hear the kind of effort we're putting into thinking as we're going along with that, with this right now. And I hope that you're enjoying this show. I hope you're enjoying this kind of serious examination of what's going on out there in the world. And I hope it's stimulating your thoughts. And I'm going to give you every opportunity I can to hear more from Peter as we move along into the future. And I think that one of the things that Peter's doing, Peter Goetze, is he's actually motivating me to not change any of my opinions, but to move toward even more openness about my opinions. A lot of people have always said, who are on the other side from me, well, he exaggerates. No, folks, I have never exaggerated. I have held back. And now I have a medical colleague who is actually pushing me a little to not hold back. Peter, it's an amazing experience.
Well, yeah, some people ask me why I am not more consensus-like. And you know, last time we spoke, Peter, I gave the example that before the Civil War in the States, if you had made a consensus committee about slavery, they might have agreed that 2 hours every Sunday they could be free, because then they could go to church and hear the Lord's words. And slavery would never have been abolished through a consensus conference. So if you really want to change things, I am not so keen about the consensus-like approach. I must say, I have also held back, Peter. Maybe people don't think so if they read my books, but actually, if you want to move people in the middle who are uncertain about what to believe, you should also be careful not to be too straightforward, I guess.
I don't know the answer. I mean, what a conversation to let our audience in on. I'm really glad to be doing this. And Ginger and I have this conversation probably to some extent every week, and sometimes more often, in regard to what I'm writing and thinking and what she's what she's texting and tweeting and what she's saying. And the fact is that this institution of psychiatry has just done monstrous, monstrous, inestimable harm through its several hundred year existence. The numbers of sheer dead through the state mental hospital system is just overwhelming. Peter Goetze, the music is starting. God bless you. And my audience, thank you for this wonderful audience. And look forward to hearing more from Peter in the future and seeing him on my website in different ways. Thank you. Thank you, Peter.